I'm Christopher Lydon with the reporter Howard French. We're talking about Africa. 50 years after the first catastrophe of the post-colonial era, the assassination of the man and the vision embodied in Patrice Lumumba, the Congo's first prime minister after the Belgian captivity ended. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. For the New York Times, Howard French has covered much of the carnage known as Africa's World War, over the Congo's mineral treasures, most of it. It's been one of the most destructive wars in modern history, and it's still taking its toll after 13 years. But Howard French travels the continent from the Ivory Coast to Tunisia, both at the top of the news recently. And he's also deep into a book on the China in Africa story. It's a very different sort of gold rush for the same old African resources. It is not colonialism this time, but will the story end more happily for the Africans? Howard French, I'm a longtime reader and admirer of yours. Thank you for taking us on and the whole continent, so to speak. But let's pay our respects first to Patrice Lumumba, an electrifying young leader killed 10 weeks after he took office, 3 days before President Kennedy took office. And by all accounts now, the Belgians approved the Lumumba killing, and the American CIA helped set it up. What if Lumumba had lived?
First of all, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I really welcome the opportunity to talk about Africa in an extended format like this, which doesn't happen enough in American media. The what if Lumumba had lived question, though, is one of these unanswerables, imponderables. It's almost I would liken it to the John F. Kennedy story.
Yeah.
Would Kennedy have been would his imagined greatness have been confirmed, or would he have been ultimately a letdown? What we do know about Lumumba and the nature of his demise is that it set Congo onto a course of permanent destabilization, and Congo being the third or fourth largest country in Africa, and a country not just immense in terms of its geographic extent, but also situated in a particularly important way, touching upon almost every region of the continent. Congo has an East African component. It has a Southern African component. It has a Central African component. And it is not far from having a Sahelian component and a West African component. Mm. So because of its situation, instability in Congo, lack of governance in the Congo, dissolution of the state in Congo sort of radiates in a way that troubles in few other African countries could. And so the way that Lumumba was undone very actively through the actions of Belgium and the United States that you cited earlier – really sort of set the tone, conditioned the early years of Central African independence particularly, but also sort of set in motion mechanisms of instability that are with the continent and with the Congo even to this day.
Two questions, Howard, about Lumumba. One, he was a man of phenomenal charm and grace and physical drive. I remember at the time somebody said, you know, if Patrice Lumumba had entered a room full of African leaders as a waiter, he would have been their leader by the time lunch was over. The second interesting point, though, is that he fell really because he was willing to go to the Soviets for help when he didn't get what he needed from the West. What if, like Nehru and other non-aligned people, he had managed to finesse that difference instead of getting caught up, as all of Africa did in the Cold War?
Well, the first thing to remember as we discuss Lumumba is how extraordinarily brief his political career was. This is like a meteor we're talking about that appeared in the sky and was gone almost before we had time to make sense of it. But charisma, because of the nature of Belgian colonialism, was one of the only tools at Lumumba's disposal. The Belgians did not create a Congolese officer corps. So as Lumumba took power in 1960 as the first head of government of this newly independent, vast newly independent state, the head of state had no armed services at his disposal. He had nothing like an intellectual class at his disposal. There were only something like 35 university graduates trained in the long years of Belgian colonial rule. None of the normal sorts of institutions that one associates with modern statehood had been fleshed out and developed by the Belgians. And so you have this charismatic figure taking power in a situation where all of the normal levers of statecraft were unavailable to him. And he then was forced to resort to the power of the verb, the power of the tongue to try to move the country in the right direction and to try to stand up against the people, those who he perceived to be the country's enemies, most particularly Belgium. The second part of your question, could you just restate that for me?
Well, roughly, could anybody have saved Africa from the Cold War? We always say, you know, the Cold War ended without a shot being fired. But, of course, Africa and much of the Third World was chewed up unmercifully in the process. And there were desperate casualties in that war. Leaping over Mobutu Sese Seko, I mean, the poster kleptocrat that the West wanted in there rather than the Soviets. I mean, we enter a period that you've covered a lot of sort of permanent war in the Congo and the neighborhood, including Rwanda, including in a certain way the massacres of 1994. I mean, we come at the end of this whole period into what many people worry is the sort of nightmare vision of how the human race ends in this sort of permanent war of all against all. It's incredibly degrading and brutal and lethal. What, 5 million people at least killed in the Congo region in the last 10, 15 years?
Mm-hmm.
How do we get there and how do we get out of it? Are we beginning to get out of it yet?
Well, the first thing I'd like to say is that Africa is a continent of 53 countries. When we look at the way Africa is covered certainly in the American news media, but also more generally in the Western news media, what we tend to see are stories about pirates in Somalia or strife in Sudan, rape in the Congo. These are the stories that tend to dominate Western news coverage of Africa. And I say this not because these are not important stories. These are important stories indeed. My concern is that Africa being a continent of 53 countries, when we latch on to a certain type of story, a certain vision of Africa, we are forgetting the life of another 700 to 800 million people in Africa who are living very different stories. And by and large, the last decade of life for these 700, 800 million other Africans has been a time of rather extraordinary progress, of some of the world's fastest economic growth in a number of countries, democratic consolidation, and in certain cases, the entry of some of these countries into what I would call the sort of currents of global economic exchange through a variety of mechanisms, one of the important ones being the entry of China or the reentry of China into the African space as a major player. So my concern really is that we have very limited bandwidth in our attention for Africa, and the bandwidth is sort of dominated by a certain kind of story about Africa that is far from representative of the broader reality of the African continent, and this is really a problem.
Two things here. I want to get to the bandwidth of the internet and how that makes it a different story for Africa going forward. We'll come to that. But I'm interested in you, Howard French, and how you came to be a reporter on Africa. What drove you to the story? What are you looking for, both in a personal and a professional way? What's your ambition? I can only say I admire it.
Thank you. I became involved in Africa by a sort of family accident. As I was heading off to college in 1975, my father was preparing to move the rest of my family, four younger brothers and sisters and my mother, to Ivory Coast to set up a regional healthcare project involving 20 African countries that was sponsored by the World Health Organization. And I was going off to Western Massachusetts to college, and my family was going off to West Africa. And I thought that this was a tremendous injustice, that I was being deprived by the luck of the draw, just birth order. I was being deprived of this incredible life experience. And it was very grim for me. So I visited Africa for the first time to visit my family that winter, that Christmas of 1975. And I subsequently visited every summer while I was a college student. And I was enchanted by the experience. I began to travel quite a bit in Africa. And I resolved, as I graduated from school, to spend my post-college year sort of before you decide to become a fully fledged adult, sort of the figure it out year I decided to spend in Africa. And I thought that I would perhaps apply to law school after that and began to make preparations for that. But then I went off to Ivory Coast and with the idea of spending a year there. And I worked as a translator, translating French and English, journalism, and a bit of literature even. One thing began to lead to another. I began to do some freelance writing, journalistic writing. I had never really previously thought about journalism as an option for me, but I sort of had always loved writing and had always loved reading, and I began to do a bit of freelance writing, and that was very stimulating. And then I was invited to substitute for a professor on the faculty of University of Ivory Coast who had to be evacuated for medical reasons, and I found myself as a professor on the English faculty of this university at the age of something like 22 years old, during which time I began doing lots more freelance writing. And the freelance writing began gradually to take off. And one of my most prominent strings, so to speak, at that time became the Washington Post. And the Post asked me eventually to venture out beyond my base in Ivory Coast and cover other stories in other parts of Africa. And so I became a full-time reporter, albeit as a freelancer, and then in 1986, the New York Times hired me. And I went to New York for years, 3.5 years, to be a Metro reporter and was then sent back out by the Times as a foreign correspondent, which I did for the next 20 years or so. Basically, Latin America, the Caribbean first, West Africa again for the New York Times, West and Central Africa, and then Japan and finally China.
Let me ask you a kind of overly crude question. I mean, people like you going to Africa for the first time, there are two kinds of extreme reactions. One is being appalled at the poverty, at the disorder, and wanting out of there. The other, I'm thinking of Skip Gates, who was discovering Africa around the same time, people who get hugely fascinated with the idea of an African Renaissance, who see Africa as a place that was spared the Industrial Revolution, class conflict, all kinds of pollution and technology that doesn't apply anymore, and see Africa as nothing but opportunity and incredibly apt people to seize it. I mean, can you put yourself between those poles in terms of, you know, what your project was going to be and what your attitude toward it was going to be?
Well, I wouldn't have chosen either of those poles if I were starting out to describe my sense of things myself. But I, having heard your description of these two poles, I'm much more in the latter camp. I was seized upon arrival in West Africa during these college visits, reading a plethora of regional magazines and you know, paying very close attention. I was a political science major in college and paying very close attention to the politics of initially of Ivory Coast, but then as I traveled more and read more of all of West and Central Africa, basically, I was really seized by how rich the political lives of these countries were. And you know, having read the American press already for several years on Africa and read a number of books about Africa in the American press, Africa was really reduced to a kind of two-dimensional realm. Mm-hmm. In the way it was depicted then, and very often still the way it's depicted. But it was not a place where, you know, in the American telling, there were politics. You had big men. Everything was reduced to a big man, and it was an almost primal kind of thing where, you know, everything's explained in either in terms of greed, brutality, or tribe. And You know, I was very quickly seized with the reality that there's a lot more going on the ground in these places, and felt a compulsion initially to try to understand as best I could. And then as I sort of got my feet underneath me as a writer, trying to convey my own sense of understanding of this richer play of ideas and of forces in African societies to an American and Western public that are largely deprived of anything so textured.
Fascinating. Put all of those good attitudes and subtle distinctions that are built into your scope here into what you have seen in all too much detail in what's come to be known as Africa's World War in the last years in and around the Congo. You've written extensively about it, and it has to shake your optimism up, but I'm sure you see much more than we do.
Well, yes. I mean, I don't have a lot of immediate optimism about the Congo per se. The Congo is going to go through a very long period of sorting out, basically. My view of how this happened is that the Rwandan genocide is the sort of starting point for this period of extended horror and extraordinary setback for Central Africa. We were coming, just to sort of set the context for you, very late in the first George H.W. Bush administration, we had the Black Hawk Down incident in Somalia, where there's a humanitarian intervention in Somalia and American Marines get killed and dragged through the streets. And this leads to a kind of brusque reappraisal of American official attitude toward Africa. And the sort of – which is crystallized in a statement that has been made with slight variations by Clinton and by the second Bush president, which says in so many words that no African crisis is worth any American life. And so because of the trauma of that the United States experienced in the Black Hawk Down incident, we – then behaved very timorously and very dishonestly in the Rwandan genocide, pretending even not to know about the genocide, even though we really did know in real time what was going on, and ordering American officials from the White House, ordering American officials essentially not to call the genocide by its name, because to do so would implies legal responsibilities under a variety of American international obligations. And so as the public sense of the horror of the genocide spreads, the Clinton administration then begins to overcorrect and engage in a policy by extreme guilt and contrition, in which essentially they say that the successor regime in Rwanda after the genocide is owed this extraordinary debt of driven by guilt from the United States and by the West. Britain, by the way, also plays a very similar guilt-driven role in post-genocide Rwanda. So we've gone through three steps. The failure to respond to the genocide. Second step, in the immediate aftermath of the genocide, large numbers of Hutu refugees fled the aftermath of the genocide into Congo. And they set up in refugee camps just across the border, often within the space of just a few miles of the Rwandan border. And the United Nations allowed huge numbers of these refugees to sort of some of whom were in fact ex-fighters of the Hutu army that had been defeated by Paul Kagame's forces and of the Hutu militias that had carried out much of the genocide. Those elements are embedded in these much larger populations of refugees just across the border from Rwanda in Congo. And so these are two failures, and they're both driven by – just to say this in the simplest code language I can, a kind of American will toward running African policy in the cheapest possible way. And so the third thing that flows from this is when – the security threat to Rwanda rose to such an extent that Paul Kagame and his regime decided that they couldn't tolerate it anymore. The United States and Britain effectively said to Paul Kagame, listen, you, Paul Kagame, go in and settle that problem however you want to, and we will make sure that nobody makes too big a stink about it. We'll personally turn a blind eye, and because of our role in the United Nations and in other world fora, we'll make sure that you can essentially get away with this. And so this is the beginning of the world war that takes place in Congo. Paul Kagame invades the Congo. It was still then Zaire, killing large numbers. I'm talking tens of thousands of Hutu refugees. We're not I'm talking about women and children and elderly people, many tens of thousands of which were slaughtered by Paul Kagame's army as they – I'm sorry, by his surrogates as they marched across the Congo to overthrow Mobutu. He installs a man who he thought would be a puppet regime in Kinshasa, Laurent Kabila. He says, Kabila, don't cooperate with the UN. Don't allow them to do anything to bring to light the atrocities that were committed here. And so this is the stage that's set for what has been called a world war in Congo.
Howard French, you remind me in a certain way of a colleague of yours at Columbia University, Mahmoud Mamdani, and a wonderful book he wrote called Saviors and Survivors. It was especially about Darfur and the Sudan. I mean, the first lesson was the West always gets it too simple. It's not heroic Tutsis and villainous Hutus all the way, and it's not just about black Africans and Arab Muslims in Sudan either. But the final moral of his work is that Western intervention tends to make things worse. Is there a case to be made that our history, the history of the West, even Western weapons and Western influence, is still compounding the problem?
The paradox is that we in the West have been at each step in this very history instrumental in creating the history, in shaping the forces of history in these African countries. In the case that you just mentioned in Sudan, in embedding distinctions that were important in the Europeans' mind between Arab and African, in colonial law in Sudan, in ways that almost ensured conflict over time. And then we come in many years later and we say we almost pretend ignorance as we, behave to intervene in a particular sort of situation in Sudan without any sort of it's paradoxical to me because it's inconceivable almost in any other part of the world. Mm. How do you unlearn the fact of history in Sudan when you've been so instrumental in shaping it in the first place?
What do we have to unlearn in the Congo, in Rwanda today, in the zone of Africa's world war to get out of the way of a solution maybe?
Well, I think that in Congo and in Rwanda, we have to get away from the idea that there are good guys and bad guys in the stark black and white sense in this story. And we have to understand that there have been atrocities, and I'm talking about very large-scale atrocities committed over time by the main participants in this conflict. I'm talking here most particularly about Hutu and Tutsi in Rwanda and Burundi and Eastern Congo. And we have to stop pretending that by suppressing knowledge of that and insisting that ethnicity is not a factor or is not a permissible subject of discussion or that democracy is not a normal human desire, that by suppressing all of these sorts of thoughts, the problems of that part of Africa will go away. We're sort of stuck at that level right now. And in my sense, this is a recipe for pressure building up until the top blows off and again at some point down the road.
Mm. Howard French, there are at least three things we have to talk about, presuming to sweep around Africa in less than an hour with you. One is Côte d'Ivoire, where Laurent Gbagbo, the incumbent who's been voted out, doesn't want to leave, but people are pushing back and saying he must, including the West, but also Tunisia. And then I want to hear about China in Africa. We could have a century coming of an entirely different kind of development. Can you make that tour?
Sure. Ivory Coast, a very important country in West Africa that has been locked in a very unfortunate cycle of ethnic demagoguery and mounting hate speech. Ivory Coast is extraordinarily important, not just because of anything inherent to Ivory Coast, but because it has been the traditional sort of economic motor for all of French-speaking West Africa and an extraordinarily important crossroads for the region, the base of large numbers of migrant workers from countries like Burkina Faso and Mali, but also even further beyond, as far away as Senegal and Chad and Nigeria. The Ivory Coast not having its problems worked out in an adequate way threatens the economy of the region and ultimately threatens the political stability of the region. I think
what is the West doing, France and the United States especially, to prevent a blow-up?
I think that the initial response – I was surprised in a positive way by the initial response from the West, by Washington and by France in taking a very clear stance about the outcome of the election urging Gbagbo, the defeated president, to recognize the results of the election and to cede power to the man who defeated him, Alassane Ouattara. And then subsequently, when Gbagbo refused to cooperate, the United States and France played an important role in a mounting campaign of economic sanctions, putting members of the regime on travel bans and seizing assets and blocking bank accounts and things like that. I think this has all been very positive. I don't think it's been adequate. And we are rapidly approaching a place where if something isn't done soon, then essentially Gbagbo will have won. There's a kind of phenomenon of attrition taking place here. And the attention of the outside world will sort of begin to wane and people will begin to wring their hands. And we're nearing this point now. And Gbagbo will just simply stay on as the de facto leader of a country whose economy is being destroyed right before our eyes. So there has been talk in regional political bodies in West Africa about using a military intervention, a regional military intervention as a last resort to remove Gbagbo from power. I think that this should be a last resort, but I think that it's important that this not merely be a bluff. Gbagbo is a very astute cynic and knows a bluff a mile away, and if this is merely talk and bluster with nothing behind it, it's going to be counterproductive. And so in order for this not to be a bluff, I think that there is a further role for the United States and other Western countries. And I'm not putting France near the top of the list here because of its colonial role in Ivory Coast, which complicates any French involvement of this nature. But there's a role for the United States and other Western countries, I think, to be played in helping the regional bodies figure out how they could conduct a military intervention if it comes to that. Mm-hmm. And by doing so, giving the possibility of a military intervention the appearance of ever greater credibility. Mm-hmm. By helping the regional powers plan and by giving them logistical support if need be, by helping them through various contingencies and sort of scenarios and war gaming it, et cetera, providing communication support, I think the United States could play a very effective role without putting any American troops into Ivory Coast or intervening in any direct way in the crisis there.
Meantime, Howard French, Tunisia has chased out its old strongman. The game isn't over, but your colleague Anthony Shadid writes in the New York Times that, in the Arab Middle East, in Africa at large, so close to Egypt, Libya, Algeria, this could be a very different century. But what do you make of that? What are the ripples in Africa?
I think that everyone in the region is watching Tunisia very carefully. But I think that there is a danger in the West of wishful thinking here in the sense that there's this antipathy that is sometimes scarcely concealed toward Arab regimes in any number of quarters in the West. And so I think this antipathy risks blinding people to reality. And people jump on the idea that, oh, there's been an uprising that's overthrown an Arab dictatorship in Tunisia, and the wishful thinking factor that I referred to then leads people to making the logical leap that, oh, this is the beginning of a pan-Arab sort of uprising, and that we're going to see the spread of Western-style democracies in the Arab world as a result of this. I think that that's getting way ahead of ourselves, and that the best way of explaining how far ahead of ourselves that would be getting is that we don't even know how Tunisia is going to turn out yet. Tunisia is a very fluid situation itself, and it's not at all clear to me, although it would be lovely if it turned out peacefully to lead to, you know, a democratic regime that is responsive to the needs of its citizens and transparent and fair and just and humane. But it's just far too early to say that that's even the outcome in Tunisia. So I'm wary of this kind of analysis that says that this is the sort of the Prague Spring of the Arab Middle East or something like that. I just don't think we're there yet.
Speaking of getting ahead of ourselves, I want you to share as much as you can of your work in progress about China in Africa. I mean, for years now, this game has been stuck around formulas of aid and trade in Africa as a development tool, and suddenly we wake up to the fact that the Chinese have been working on an entirely different model all over Africa with big bucks, big ambitions. A whole new era is beginning with Chinese investment. What's to make of it? Is it the same old but different? How does it end?
Well, it's a work in progress, but what seems certain to me is that China has behaved in a very smart sense with great opportunism over the last 10 years, looking at the rest of the world and asking itself sort of two basic questions. One is, we, China, are what kind of economy, and therefore what sorts of needs do we really have to meet in a sort of first order kind of sense? And the answer to that question is, we, China, are a manufacturing and export-based economy that requires huge amounts of natural resource inputs in order to keep our furnaces stoked. And therefore, we need to supply ourselves with everything from energy to wood to uranium to copper to cobalt to bauxite to iron to on and on and on and on ad infinitum. So the second question is, if you are a rising power like China, where does it make sense to invest your chips? And you could think of several different kinds of answers. One would be, okay, so we're feeling our oats and we'll go head-to-head with the United States or with other established powers in places where they are already strongest. Well, China didn't answer the question that way. China said, we are a rising power and we have a certain number of chips to invest. Let's invest them in places that are relatively neglected, that are relatively under where the West and other established players are relatively underrepresented. And so both of these questions, the questions of what kind of economy and country are we and what are our needs, and the question of we're a rising power and where does it make the best sense to sort of place our chips, led China in the direction of Africa. Africa being the world's preeminent storehouse of mineral and other natural resource wealth, and Africa being this continent which, as I have said earlier here in another context, where the West has basically run a policy on the cheap of doing everything in the cheapest way it possibly can, obtaining maximum benefit with minimal investment. And so China comes in and says, we can do better than that. We're willing to put down substantial amounts of money and to make big gestures and to seal really big deals in order to establish relationships here. And This isn't something that's here today and gone tomorrow, but it's a long-term play that's driven by a long-term sense of who we are, the Chinese, and what our interests are. And so that's what we're witnessing here. And you, I think you used the phrase that the West has woken up to this idea. I think that's exactly the right metaphor, that the West has been sleeping on Africa since at least since the end of the Cold War. And the Chinese, being very astute sort of strategic thinkers, were aware of that and saw this as a kind of near vacuum that they could move in on and answer a lot of – meet a lot of their needs with in a very short order, very effectively.
It sounds, Howard French, like, you know, a business deal, China making long-term contracts over resources and whatnot. But is it not political? I mean, I guess what I'm really asking is why – to go back to the beginning with Patrice Lumumba, why were we happy to be rid of a guy who would, in a pinch, deal with the Soviets? And we don't see the Chinese in Africa. For one thing, they don't come moralistically or politically or with pretenses of a civilizing mission. But why does it not, in some sense, alarm us as it did 50 years ago?
Well, I think that very belatedly it has begun to alarm some people in you know, policy circles in the United States. I note that, you know, in the WikiLeaks material that was released about Africa, that the Assistant Secretary of State, Johnny Carson, you know, had some very interesting language in which, you know, he was essentially painting the Chinese as the bad guys, saying that, you know, they are not really Africa's friends and that they're really after, you know, trying to lock down Africa's resources and that the game that they're talking is not sincere, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The real problem for the United States in this regard, though, is that, you know, I've referred to having Africa policy run on the cheap. We are not used to in this country thinking of Africa in serious terms. We are not used to thinking about Africa as a place where serious things happen or where there are serious stakes. We've just come out – we're just coming out of a period, the Black Hawk Down language that I described earlier, in which we have – our official policy has been essentially summarized saying in the words of, you know, no African crisis is worth an American life. George W. Bush said that Africa has no strategic – the United States has no strategic national security interest in Africa. These are extraordinary statements. We used to think of Africa as a burden, as a problem, as a place where, you know, there are corrupt regimes that we have leverage over and at the end of the day we can get what we want from them pretty cheaply. We're not used to thinking of Africa as a place where we have to invest in relationships and that, you know, where there is lots of opportunity. And here's the vital distinction with China. Yes, China sees Africa as, among other things, a really important natural resource play. But what we are only beginning, and this is just the first inklings, I think, to understand at this stage, is that China's play in Africa goes far beyond that. China sees Africa as a land of opportunity, not just to extract things, but to sell things to. China sees Africa as this place where the population is 1 billion today and by mid-century it will be 2 billion. And that there are very fast-growing middle classes that by mid-century, even in a continent of mixed political fortunes, will be very important, will be huge. And so with the West and Japan locked in this post-industrial funk where we are heavily indebted and we have financial crises and slow growth and things like this, China is saying as an exporter, as a manufacturer, we have to figure out where the markets of the future are going to be. They're not going to be in the United States. They're going to be in places like Africa. And we have to invest in helping make a go of these places now while they're, you know, in this rapid growth phase of 1 billion going to 2 billion people in the space of just a few decades. If we can be part of the spark of getting these places going and build these kinds of relationships with these countries, we won't just be taking stuff away from them. We will have extraordinary markets there and we'll largely have them to ourselves because the West doesn't make the stuff, you know, as middle-class Africans are buying cars and building houses and, you know, shopping malls and airports and all the other stuff that, you know, that is associated with the rise to a modicum of affluence. You know, those are the things that China makes.
That's fascinating and very vivid, and I don't want to say threatening, but it's a different world. I just wonder, maybe this is my last question, Howard, among those aid geniuses who argue about trade and aid as America's next gift to Africa, in the face of all this Chinese activity, buying forests or building railroads or planning the sales of billions of cell phones, that kind of thing, what is the West's alternative? Or what is the West's, you know, better bet? Do they have one? Or are we still asleep?
I think we're still asleep. You know, I've just come back from a month in Africa researching my book, which is – my book is essentially about Chinese migration to Africa. And I'm looking at this changing relationship between China and the continent mostly through the lens of recent Chinese migrants to Africa. But I was in five countries in Africa in the last 5 weeks: Ethiopia, Mozambique, South Africa, Namibia, and Liberia.
Mm.
And this involved quite a bit of flying around back and forth. You know, I haven't tallied the miles, probably 7,000-8,000 miles of airplane trips in the continent. And I was struck by something I couldn't help but notice every time I got on an airplane. The Westerners on the planes tended to be either, in the case of Eastern and Southern Africa, tourists. So rich Americans going to see lions and giraffes, or aid workers and NGO people.
Hmm.
So people who are coming with a mission to kind of minister to Africans about capacity building and democracy and what my father used to do, public health and things like this. I say none of this with scorn, but it's important to understand the very different mission that Americans and Westerners generally have toward Africa versus that of the Chinese, and by doing so to understand the consequences. The Chinese that I saw on these planes, and by the way, 10 years ago I saw no Chinese on these sorts of planes. Now they're, you know, maybe a fifth of all the passengers on the flights that I was flying on, are all, almost to a person, there as business people. Mm-hmm. They're people who have pulled up their stakes in wherever they lived, in Sichuan province or on Henan province or wherever, and they have come to make it in China, in Africa, and they're not leaving until they do. And whatever it takes, you know, for them to make a breakthrough, whether it's in farming or whether it's in small industry or whether it's in commerce or whatnot, they're gonna work 20 hours a day till they make it. And they see Africa as a place of extraordinary growth opportunity, of the possibility to make a fortune and to sink to throw down some roots. These are not people who are there for, you know, a couple of years. They're thinking about building new lives for themselves in Africa. So you have this totally different perspective about Africa from the between the Westerners and these recent newcomers, the new Chinese migrants. One who sees Africa as a patient, essentially, to be lectured to be ministered to be cared for. The other, which sees Africa and Africans as a place of doing business and as partners, and as a, you know, where there's opportunity and there's no looking down one's nose or pretending to superiority. It's all about, you know, how I can make something work here. And I think that there are extraordinary consequences that people here have not even begun to understand that flow from this.
Howard French, those are big generalizations made very, very discreetly and delicately, I think. But let me ask one last question. Do the Chinese come with the kind of racism that the West did? And also, have they made an allowance for what Africans are going to get out of this relationship?
You know, I spent a lot of time – I speak Chinese, and so this has allowed me to get inside of the lives and the minds of many of the Chinese that I encountered on this trip. And very often this led to certain confidences. One of the things that became very clear to me is that there is very surely a phenomenon that one might call Chinese racism, in which you know, a certain discourse about Africans as being incapable or lazy or lacking in intelligence or unready. I guess variations of that phrase were the most common that in my hearing. One guy said to me just last week in Liberia that essentially that there's a 1,000-year gap between them and us, meaning culturally, educationally, and just sort of temperamentally, the ability to save, to sacrifice, to commit to a long-term project, to think about things in terms of deferral of pleasure and of gratification and commitment to a vision for long-term building of something. That's what the man was talking about in this particular conversation. So yes, there are certainly notes of what one might call racism. There's an important distinction to be made, though, and that is that up until this point, these sorts of attitudes have not been associated with differential power. In other words, Western racism was instrumentalized to justify the enslavement of black people, the sale of black people and their enslavement across the ocean in other to work as animals of labor on other continents. You know, Chinese racism is, comparatively speaking, up until this point, a largely rhetorical phenomenon. And therefore, I believe, without common measure with Western racism. As in certain countries, we see Chinese populations take strong root, and if they comport themselves in ways that Africans perceive to be abusive, then this risks becoming a much bigger problem. But up until this point in time, I don't believe that it is widely perceived among Africans as a big issue.
And finally, what does Africa get out of the deal?
Well, you asked – so are Chinese people thinking about earlier, you know, what Africans get out of the deal? I don't think that that's how human beings behave generally, that you don't go set off to Brazil to figure out or to Vietnam or to, you know, Ukraine to figure out what are they going to get out of the deal. Most people are motivated by – in launching into whatever venture they launch into by thinking what they're going to get out of the deal. And I think that that's – that's characteristic of human nature, and I think so. That's just to be fair to the Chinese side of this equation. I think that's where Chinese people are principally coming from. What Africans get out of the deal is a separate question and a very interesting and important question, and I think a question which will have differential answers and outcomes over time. This is a really important moment for Africa in the sense that, because the West had this long post-Cold War period of essentially neglect of Africa on the cheap, where Africa's options economically and politically speaking in the world were very much constrained because there was no great interest in Africa from outside and certainly no competition for Africa's attention, its allegiance, its opportunities, etc. The arrival of the Chinese and the way that the Chinese are coming, with the energy that the Chinese are coming, with the sense of long-term engagement and commitment that the Chinese are coming, is an incredible opportunity for Africa. It's an opportunity that will be missed by some countries, and it's an opportunity that will be seized to differing degrees of effectiveness by other countries. And these differential outcomes will be determined by, in my view, the following factors. The degree to which an elite in any given African country can elaborate and sustain a vision of its own national interest. If you don't have a policy based on, as China does, on what its national interests are, then you have no hope in dealing with any powerful outsider who comes to, you know, seek opportunity in your midst. That's the first thing. The second thing is, how do states get elites, governing elites that behave in this responsible way, where they take a broad and deeply informed view of national interest, and national interest being intended in a comprehensive sense as not the interests of the people in the equivalent of the White House. But do you get a situation like that? You get a government like that, where you have a vigorous civil society and where you have democratic feedback. And so I think that countries, African countries, where you have more vigorous civil societies and where you have more vigorous democratic feedback will, as a general proposition, stand a better chance of getting good results from this Chinese engagement. They will have media that condemn Chinese abuses when there are Chinese abuses. They will have civil society groups and press that say this oil deal or this mining contract or this paving of a new national highway or the building of a new stadium in exchange for X, Y, or Z is a good deal or is a bad deal. And on the following basis, there will be a discussion about these realities that the citizens can partake in and provide feedback to their leaders and ultimately in the more democratic states use as a basis for acceptance or rejection of their leaders. In states that are stuck in this kind of kleptocratic authoritarian mode, the Chinese will come and they will pay cash on the barrel for whatever they want and all of the contracts will go through the state house. And none of the money or very little of it will enter the public budget. And even the monies that enter the public budget won't be spent for the greater public good. And 20 years from now, China will have exhausted all of the bauxite or all of the copper or all of the iron ore. And the Chinese answer will be, don't blame us. We paid you exactly the amount that we said we were going to pay you. It's not our fault if you have twice as many people and all of your iron ore is finished. We paid you on time and exactly the amount that was negotiated. But that money, those monies will have been frittered away on Mercedes and big villas and houses in France and Geneva and Los Angeles and in Swiss bank accounts, et cetera, et cetera. And a disaster will then loom for those countries, which will be, as I said, twice as populous and bereft of their natural resources.
Howard French, you do exciting work and you talk us through it with fascinating clarity. I've got to say, I can't thank you enough for this hour, and I'm sure we'll talk again.
Thank you very much, Chris.
Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feed back on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.